The Cognitive Behavioral Therapy Center of Western North Carolina would like to welcome you to this episode of our podcast, brought to you by BehaviorTherapist.com. Each episode presents news and interviews pertaining to the cognitive behavioral therapies and evidence-based psychotherapy, containing content for consumers and professionals alike. In this episode, Dr. Anne Marie Albano on childhood anxiety disorders. Before introducing Dr. Albano, I'd like to request that you visit us on the web at http://behaviortherapist.podbean.com. At that location, you can enjoy the free resources that support the podcast, as well as post questions and comments. Please also consider visiting our e-store at that same location, as the proceeds go to help defray costs associated with producing the podcast. On to Dr. Albano. Dr. Albano is Associate Professor of Clinical Psychology and Psychiatry at Columbia University and Director of the Columbia University Clinic for Anxiety and Related Disorders. She received her PhD from the University of Mississippi, interned at the Boston VA Tufts Consortium, and completed a postdoctoral fellowship at the Center for Stress and Anxiety Disorders at SUNY Albany. She is a founding fellow of the Academy of Cognitive Therapy, a Beck Institute scholar, and is board certified in clinical child and adolescent psychology. Dr. Albano, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Why don't we start out with discussing, so that we're all clear, what exactly is anxiety? How would we define that?
Well, anxiety is one of our basic human emotions. Everyone has it, actually. Any kind of animal has it. And what anxiety is an emotion that helps to prepare you, to alert you to possible danger or to some sort of negative consequence. So it is evolutionarily based, and it's a normally occurring signal that occurs through our nervous system, and then also a way of processing information that develops over time so that we could be safe and productive in the world.
I imagine that there's some amounts of anxiety based on what you said that are normative, and I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about what might be normative for children and adolescents.
Well, one of the things we know is that anxiety itself has been studied in depth, and one of the forms of anxiety, known as fear, has also been studied in depth in terms of what's normal for fear development according to age and stage. So what we understand is that fears begin very early, from infancy on, and across the studies that have been done in the U.S. and around the world, we find that there are certain types of fears that are typical of certain ages and stages. Infants might fear separation and strangers. As the child is moving towards 4, 5, and 6 years of age, they also start to fear small animals, things that could harm them, imaginary situations, fear of the dark. And as they're moving towards childhood, first, second, third grade, you start seeing fears of doctors and dentists, which again are interpreted as harmful by the child or misinterpreted that way, thunder and lightning. And it's by the adolescent years that fears change to being worry or concern about being negatively evaluated. We've studied fears over time. We know that the number of fears decreases with age. We know that the focus of the fear changes with age, and that typically girls report more fears than boys. And this is consistent across different cultures. And then also when it comes to worry, worry is a normal event, and that most children, adolescents, and even those of us who are over the age of 21, worry about what's going to happen next, what we need to do, how to prepare ourselves for things like exams or meetings and such. And again, this is a normal thing that occurs, but it can be very productive to motivate an individual. So these are all the normative aspects or normal aspects of worry and fear in children.
So what would you say to parents who are wondering whether or not the anxiety's crossed the line from being normative to something that maybe they should be concerned about?
Yes, well, this is one of the things that we look at, and one of the main questions that comes in is my child having an anxiety disorder situation, or is this something that's just going to pass? Well, one of the things to know is that we expect children and adolescents to have spikes of anxiety at different points in time. But spikes in anxiety because it's exam period, or because we're starting a new school, or because the child is starting to do oral reports, or they're being asked to go places with peers that they haven't been with before, such as to parties or overnight and such. These types of spikes in anxiety are pretty transient. They happen but resolve very quickly, and they're usually associated with a circumscribed event. But the thing of it is, children, adolescents, move into these things, learn how to master them pretty quickly, and the overall impact of getting more and more reinforcement and positive attention from teachers, from peers, from parents, resolves that anxiety so kids move forward. Now, what we tell parents is that if the child, if their anxiety is out of proportion, is so much more than what would be expected, that's a sign that, well, maybe we need to take a look at this. That is, if the child is really crying, if they're worried to the point that they can't relax and settle down, if they can't think about the positive aspects of what they may be encountering, that's troublesome. We also look at if the child doesn't, over time, get used to the situation that they're anxious about. That is, they become increasingly more fearful about going to school and sitting at the table with the other children in kindergarten or first grade, and they start crying the night before and begging not to go. Or we look at children who, over time, they can't get used to animals and, you know, seeing dogs walking down the street or in the park, different things like that. If the fear reaction sticks and grows in intensity, that's troublesome. And then the other thing parents have to look at is if the fear is, and anxiety is focused on something very innocuous, something that shouldn't cause anyone really to be worried or to be upset. So we look at those things. Intensity of the fear, does the fear reaction stick and not habituate? And is it focused on something that really is not something to cause worry?
Now, what might be some risk factors for a child or adolescent to, in terms of developing an anxiety disorder? Parents will worry about that sometimes.
Well, there's a number of different risk factors. There's not any one, let's say, that would tip a child over, except in the case we, you know, typically of a very traumatic stressor, a traumatic event in which the child may have been harmed or could have lost their life. And, of course, we see this in children who live in areas where there's a lot of war or terrorism or impoverished neighborhoods that are high in crime. That's a different story, okay? But typically, the risk factors we look at, the number one risk factor is called temperament. And this is, if you think about the infant personality, some infants are very slow to warm up to their parents and to people. They tend to be hesitant to explore the world around them, crawl around. They get very anxious and cry and when a stranger enters the room. They could be very clingy to their parents. This is the inhibited temperament, and it's been the temperament that's associated with later anxiety for some kids. And that's different from the infant who can soothe themselves and the parents hear them gurgling and playing in their cribs, or the infant who's difficult and just is crying all the time no matter what the parent does. The inhibited temperament is the one where you think of a clingy, shy, scared, more than anything, infant and baby and toddler. That is a risk factor. Other risk factors include family history. If there's been a history of anxiety or depression in the parents, grandparents, first-degree relatives, that could lend a risk that may be genetic, but at the same time it could also be an environmental risk because the child is being raised in a situation where they're being able to observe and see the effects of anxiety or anxiety working in the family members. So this goes to early experiences also in the environment. And if the environment is disrupted in different ways due to another family member's anxiety or depression, or due to other things such as real difficult family circumstances, parents not having a good marriage, you know, and there's a lot of discord, That's a risk factor. And the other things we tend to look at are the way that the child over time develops their own psychological coping resources. And that is where you listen to how the child interprets what's going on in the world. So if they're on the playground and they're little, 4 or 5 years of age, if they're saying things such as, I'm not going to go play on the gym equipment or, you know, on the playground equipment because I could fall and hurt myself, if the parent hears that a lot, you have to wonder, why are they afraid of things that other children are running up to and jumping on? So watch the way that they interpret the world, and if there's the glass is half empty type of approach and things can hurt me, you know, that could be worrisome. Their coping resources are not being developed to be positive and proactive. And finally, one of the biggest risk factors, too, that we found is parental rearing style. That is the way that parents parent their children. And the two types of parental styles that are found in anxiety disorders are overprotection and overcontrol. Overprotection is where the parents are doing everything possible to keep the child happy and not have them experience any typical childhood negative outcome. Not all children are going to be invited to parties. That can be upsetting. But if parents really work hard to try and prevent that, the child doesn't get experience with that, and then they could become very rejection sensitive over time or not understand how to work with relationships. If the parent is really, if the parent works to make sure the child always has the nicest, warmest, most compassionate teacher, they're preventing the child from seeing that there's all sorts of personalities, and boy, we've had teachers with many different types of personalities. This is setting them up for not understanding that when they get out into the world as they age, there's going to be people who may be more loud or a bit more rambunctious or whatever, and they've got to be able to handle that. So overprotection is one of the parental rearing traps. The other is overcontrol, and that's where they try to put everything in place for the child, and they get over-involved in doing things for the child, so the child then doesn't learn how to struggle with problems. So those are the big risk factors.
And the answer to my next question, to some degree, was implied with some of what you said, but I wonder if you could make more explicit. So let's say parents identify some of these risk factors in their families or children. Are there some things that parents can do to prevent the onset of an anxiety disorder, and if so, what?
Well, that's a very good question. We don't understand well yet prevention in anxiety, but what we do understand is that this overprotection is definitely a trap. So what we encourage parents to do is to work with their children in a way that when the child comes in upset or concerned about something that's making them anxious, don't swoop in to fix it. Instead, talk with the child about what is it that they're worried about. Ask questions about, well, what do you think will be happening? How likely is that to happen? Have you seen that happen before with anyone else? What did they do? Now, this actually leads to understanding a study that we've done, and also colleagues in Australia actually were the first to do. It was a study of looking at parent-child interactions around managing difficult problems in social settings. And what was found, actually, is that if you give parents and children an ambiguous social situation to discuss, the situation, for example, you go into a cafeteria, you sit down at a table with a group of kids, some of them you know very well and some you don't. Some of the kids there are popular. They're all talking about what they're going to do this weekend. How would you feel and what would you do? Well, what research has shown in using these types of situations is that children without anxiety will tend to look at that situation and say, well, they'd be feeling fine, they wouldn't be anxious, and they'd talk to the kids, they'd join in, they'd figure out what to do. And actually, when their parents talk with them about this situation, they focus them on, hey, what could you ask? Or, hey, can you maybe invite them to do something? They focus on the positive aspects of that. But parents of children of anxiety disorders, although the children might be somewhat anxious, they typically, before discussing it with the parents, talk about staying and trying to listen and hear what the kids have to say. After the parental discussion, the children with anxiety disorders tend to change their plans to say, I'd go find another table. I'd sit somewhere else. And what has been found in the discussion with the parents is that the parents tend to focus in on ambiguous cues and misinterpret them as dangerous. So the parents will say things like, you know, there are popular kids there. Will that make you uncomfortable? Or you haven't been going out a lot, so maybe you wouldn't feel like sitting with those kids because they're pretty active. Now, we call this the fear effect, family enhancement of anxious responding. And we do not think or blame parents. We don't think they're causing anxiety, and we don't blame them for this. What it is we think that the longer a child has had anxiety, the more the parent has come to be shaped to try and protect them from experiencing more anxiety. So they develop a way of relating to their children to help them get out of situations and interpret situations more quickly in a negative way to get out of them in case they're going to be threatening. This is what we have to help parents change. Change the way you work with kids and don't give them solutions, but help lead them to coping-focused, proactive solutions. Maybe I'll sit at that table and try to talk to the kids I kind of know and see what's going on and listen, rather than jump to, oof, I don't know all these kids and some are popular, I've got to get out of there.
Should parents, sometimes parents, if one or more parents has an anxiety disorder themselves, they're concerned about the transmission of this to their children and so forth. How concerned should they be about that?
Well, you're thinking about, or parents there are thinking about something called the modeling effect. And this modeling effect that observing someone else doing something or behaving in certain ways or emitting certain emotions is transferred. Well, this has been demonstrated, goes back to work by a famous psychologist, Albert Bandura, that showed that children who watched a child being aggressive with a specific type of toy will then be aggressive with that toy and so on. And actually, we know from other work in developmental psychology that children resonate with their parents' emotions from the time they are infants. So parents should be concerned in that, yes, you know, the child is going to be tuned into you. And this is where we very much encourage parents who themselves are suffering with anxiety to try and take control of their anxiety and manage it through effective therapies that are available, like cognitive behavioral therapy or medication, to try and do this so that you become a coping model for your child. Now, this doesn't mean you've got to be the Terminator, Arnold Schwarzenegger, I could take on anything kind of a character for your child. That's not what we're talking about. And in fact, parents are good models, as are others, for showing that, yeah, some things do make us anxious, so you report that, you know, this makes me anxious, but how can I deal with this? What can I do so that I can manage this situation in a way that's best for me? That's the kind of thing they have to start doing if they themselves have these kinds of disorders, so their child could see that their parents taking control of it and they can do that too.
I wonder if we could talk about shyness for a minute. Should parents be concerned if their child or adolescent is shy, and what general sorts of information would be helpful for them to know?
Well, in general, shyness is not problematic. And in fact, there's always, whenever there are studies about social anxiety disorder, otherwise known as social phobia, you know, sometimes there's great criticism in the press that we are medicalizing shyness. But that's not what it is at all. Anxiety disorders and social anxiety disorders distinguished from shyness. Shyness itself is a normally distributed personality type. And individuals who are shy may be slower to warm up in novel social situations, but they do. They enter these situations over time. They get used to them. Now, they're not going to necessarily be the life of the party, and these might not be the individuals, the children who run for class president, but they might have a role in the student government in some way, and they'll find ways that are comfortable for them of being involved. So that is what is shyness, is just it's being more reserved, a little more slow to warm up, but you're involved. Social phobia, which is very different, is a condition where the individual is suffering with great distress, with anxiety, physical symptoms, fear of being in these situations to such a degree that they withdraw from social contact. And so as you see children who develop social phobia, instead of taking on more and more friendships and being active and excited about social events at school and different things, they shy away from these things. I hate to use that word, but they withdraw from these situations. They spend a lot of time in their room, a lot of time at home, and they don't rise to a level of interacting on any normative level socially. So they're suffering, and it's very different from shy. Now, if I was a parent, I'd look at and I'd talk to my child if they're exhibiting shyness about how they feel, what they're thinking, and I'd be listening for whether the child is saying, I want to go, I hope a friend can come with me, it'll be more comfortable that way, that's great. But if the child is talking about the situation as, I don't like it, the people are mean, nobody likes me, I'm not going to have friends, people are going to laugh at me, that's social anxiety talking. That's a different thing.
You've given us a good overview of social phobia, and I'm wondering if you could briefly tell us about some of the other major anxiety disorders that you'd find in kids.
Sure.
And what they look like.
We have, anxiety comes in a lot of flavors, unfortunately. But the big three, the child anxiety triad, is social phobia, separation anxiety disorder, and generalized anxiety disorder. These three typically co-occur with one or two, sometimes even three of them together. They show very strong associations with each other over time and over the long term, and they're distinct from the other anxiety disorders in different ways, but they tend to be treated in the same way. The three of them can be treated with the same type of cognitive behavioral therapy and the same types of medications if we go that route. Separation anxiety disorder is extreme distress and upset when parents are going to be away from the child. Even for the child to go to school, the child doesn't want to sleep in their own bed. The child gets very upset even if the parent needs to just run an errand out of the house for a half hour. So it's extreme distress upon separation and a lot of complaints, begging, crying, and attempts to be with the parent. Typically occurs in younger children in terms of its onset, but it can last throughout the lifetime. Generalized anxiety disorder is worry. And in fact, parents call their children worry warts or little adults because they worry about anything that could go wrong. And now, the thing is, everybody worries, but this is a degree of worry that the child cannot control, and they don't accept reassurance from parents, from teachers, or whoever they're with. And there's a lot of physical symptoms that go along with this too, such as irritability, headaches, stomach aches, muscle aches and pains. So little worriers with generalized anxiety disorder have a great deal of difficulty getting through everyday situations, homework, and things like that, because they're always afraid that something bad's going to happen. So those three, separation, social, and generalized anxiety, occur pretty often together. We also have obsessive-compulsive disorder in children, which are obsessions that are unusual and frightening, and the corresponding rituals that children develop to deal with those. It actually makes the disorder worse. And then we could see specific phobias, which are the most common of the anxiety disorders, and this is when fears of things like animals, insects, thunder and lightning get so out of proportion, the child, their life is interfered with in a way they can't enjoy typical activities, or children with specific phobia of medical procedures or doctors are very difficult to get into the doctor. Their health could be at risk. So that's another anxiety disorder. And then as you move towards adolescence, you see panic disorder that can onset, which is sudden, spontaneous panic attacks that occur. And oftentimes at adolescence, panic disorder is one of the conditions that leads to school refusal behavior in this age group because they're afraid of being caught at school with a panic attack that they would be unable to control and could be very embarrassing or disabling to them.
Say a parent decides that their child or adolescent might benefit from some professional help. What steps would you recommend that they take?
Well, here's good news about the anxiety disorders. Although we see that about 13 out of every 100 children and adolescents suffer with an anxiety disorder, we do know that these are highly treatable conditions. They can be treated, and they can be treated very successfully. What I would do if I were a parent, first of all, I would look up credible information from credible resources on the web. And you could look at the Anxiety Disorders Association of America, the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, or there's two great websites that are connected, the Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Therapies and the Society for Clinical Child and Adolescent Psychology. All of these websites have good information for parents about how to recognize anxiety and how to get treatment, and also some provide links to where a professional who's been trained in the right treatments can be sought. Now, the treatments for childhood anxiety has been shown through a huge National Institutes of Mental Health clinical trial. I was one of the investigators. We looked at cognitive behavioral therapy, a certain type of medication, and their combination together. And the medication was what's known as an SSRI, sertraline was what was used in the study. What we found in 488 children and adolescents with the big three anxieties was that the combination got 80% of those children better who had that medication. So the combination treatment gives you the most bang for the buck and the best chance of a full recovery. That was followed by the cognitive behavioral therapy, which gets upwards of 60 or more percent of children well just by itself. And also then the medication wasn't much different from the cognitive behavioral therapy. About 55% of children with the medication only responded. And all three of these treatments were significantly different from placebo. So the good news is cognitive behavioral therapy is the psychosocial therapy that works. And this study was a definitive study. We've known cognitive behavioral therapy has worked for years, but this was the big study that compared it to medication, that combined it with medication, and looked at it in comparison to a placebo. So parents need to ask very detailed questions of therapists as to whether they understand cognitive behavioral therapy and are actually trained in it, because the only limiting factor to finding treatment is that not everyone does this treatment.
Well, Dr. Urbano, I suspect you've been very helpful to some families today, and I really want to thank your time. Thank you for your time today.
Oh, thank you so much, and I hope people have some hope for this, because anxiety is a highly treatable condition, and we've seen many, many children over the years who do so well following their treatment with cognitive behavioral therapy.
I definitely think you've instilled some great hope there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tune in next time when we speak with Dr. Irving Kirsch about antidepressants and their effectiveness. Still to come, we'll be speaking with Lee Kern of Structure House, Teresa McKeon of Tag Teach International, and more on future episodes of the Cognitive Behavioral Therapy Center of Western North Carolina podcast. Don't forget to visit us on the web at http://behaviortherapist.podbean.com. Thank you, and we look forward to next time.